I'm Melissa Harris Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
Started with 7, got up to 10, then next time you look around, it's 18. When it got up to 40, it got up to 50, and after that, you have 60 guys and one wing had corona.
You're listening to the voice of Ronnie Lauderdale, a 63-year-old married father and grandfather. Incarcerated for a nonviolent crime in a federal facility near Lexington, Kentucky, Mr. Lauderdale faced the COVID pandemic behind prison walls. Without access to personal protective equipment and unable to maintain physical distance from others, Mr. Lauderdale, who is diabetic, soon contracted the virus.
I got to coughing. I was coughing real bad. Well, I couldn't stop, like something was in my throat. And then the fever started. Once the fever started, I began to have cold chill at night and break out in a cold sweat. And the taste buds had completely went away, so I could stop eating.
Late last year, Mr. Lauderdale told his story as part of the project If Prison Walls Could Talk from the Vera Institute for Justice.
It was close to 2 months before my wife realized I had corona. They turned the phones off, so no one could talk to their family.
Ronnie Lauderdale survived coronavirus, and he credits fellow inmates who banded together to care for one another when it felt as though they'd been abandoned to perish. Now, after his ordeal, Mr. Lauderdale filed an appeal for compassionate release, which was finally granted by a judge. But the getting out part, that's the part of his story that is very rare. Recent reporting from the Marshall Project and The Guardian reveals just how rare. According to their reporting, 31,000 people imprisoned in federal facilities sought compassionate release as the deadly virus engulfed the ill-equipped federal prison system. The Bureau of Prisons approved only 36. 36, while 49,000 federal prisoners fell ill from the virus and 256 perished. With me now is Carrie Blakinger, staff writer at the Marshall Project. Carrie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before we jump into the numbers you've been reporting, can you talk to us a little bit about what are the different ways that people were able to be released from Bureau of Prison facilities during the pandemic?
Well, there's two main ways. One is home confinement, and the other is compassionate release. And home confinement, technically the person is still an inmate, and they've just been sent to finish their sentence at home. That's the decision that's entirely up to the Bureau of Prisons. And now, as the pandemic seems to be coming to a close, those people might have to come back to prison. The more permanent way to get out is compassionate release, which is when you ask the prison system to, you know, recommend you to get out. And as I reported, most of the time they deny that. And then you have the option to appeal to a judge. And the judges are a little more apt to agree and let someone out. And in those situations, if you get out on compassionate release, like, you are out, your sentence is over, you are no longer an inmate, and they're not going to send you back when the pandemic is over.
Right. I mean, you might still be under some kind of state-based supervision, like parole, but you're not. You finished your sentence.
You finished your sentence, and there's not parole in the federal system. This is why federal prisoners end up doing a lot higher percentage of their sentence than is often the case in state systems, because there's no parole. There are situations where you can end up in a halfway house, but that's typically the people on home confinement. Usually when you're getting out on compassionate release, unless you're agreeing to do some sort of monitoring as part of your terms of compassionate release, like, you know, you would just be out. Typically it's called a reduction in sentence, because they, like, just end your sentence.
So I think part of what I found most stunning, just relative to the numbers that you all reported, is that the numbers for compassionate release actually went down during the pandemic. So prior to COVID, it was in the, like, mid-50s, and it goes down to the mid-30s. So we're still talking about very small numbers relative to the numbers who are applying for it. But that gap between the number applying and the number who actually are granted it, at least by the Bureau of Prisons, that gap opens during a pandemic.
Yes, I know. It was so shocking. You know, even to me, as someone who reports on this and is thinking about these issues and talking to people day in and day out, Even I was surprised by that. And usually when I would tell people, when I would, you know, call people to interview them and tell them about this data, they would say, oh, well, they'd assume I meant as a percentage. They would be like, oh, well, there's more people that applied during the pandemic, so of course it's a lower percent. And I'm like, no, it's raw numbers. Like the raw number of people that BOP greenlit for release was less after the pandemic, which you know, is shocking. And like I said, there were far more applications. In 2019, there were about 1,700 people who asked for compassionate release. And, you know, after the pandemic, there's been around 31,000, and yet fewer of those were approved.
Now, why? So again, I know this a bit from having read it, but why is the Bureau of Prisons saying that people are not, can't be released, even though you have somewhat more, a little bit of an uptick in it with judges being willing to release?
You know, we don't get a lot of insight. There are some sort of generic reasons that are included in some of the data that's been released. But I mean, I think it sort of comes down to that, you know, jailers want to jail. Like, they're not brought up in a culture to be releasing people. And I think that's sort of at the heart of it. But to some degree, this is just speculation, because we only sort of get form answers. We don't get a lot of sort of granular detail until things move into federal court. And then sometimes you get more nuanced discussions from the DOJ as to why they think someone should or shouldn't be released.
Yeah, I think for me, that was part of what was stunning was, you know, we are in the midst of a pandemic. You saw, especially in prisons, these rates increasing dramatically with COVID exposure. And then the Bureau of Prisons didn't have to give a reason.
Right. I will say one of the more appalling reasons when things get into federal court is that oftentimes the DOJ would oppose release, saying that it was safer to leave someone in prison.
Okay. Yeah. So, Carrie, tell me another story. Talk to me about Sean McQuitty and how he exemplifies the problem in this system.
Yeah. So this was a really heartbreaking story to tell. The McQuitty brothers, because they were both sent to prison, Daryl and Sean, they grew up in the projects of Nashville, and they ended up sort of turning to the one reliable source of income that the people around them were doing, which was selling drugs. And they turned out to be quite good at it, ended up running a very successful crack house, and then got arrested in 1997. And Daryl, who was the brother that was in charge of it, got 25 years. But Sean, who worked below him in this, you know, in their crack house, he got a mandatory life sentence because of two times that he had let a 17-year-old work a few hours in the crack house. And throughout their time in prison, the brothers kept in touch by email. They, you know, had these plans for what they were going to do if they could get out someday. And Daryl was going to get out and start a dump truck company and hire Sean to drive for him. And then sentencing reform came along, and Daryl qualified for a shorter sentence because his pre-sentencing report only listed powder cocaine, but Sean's also listed crack. So even though they were both doing these things together, just sort of this fluke of the paperwork, Sean didn't qualify for a sentence reduction and Daryl did. And so Daryl got out in 2015, and they still talked every day and they kept in touch. And, you know, Sean was still trying to get a sentence reduction as well. And, you know, hoped that he was apparently had great faith that he would not die in prison and that he would someday come home. And he applied for compassionate release in August, and the warden did not respond. And then they, you know, went to court, and the judge had not made a decision by the time that he started coughing in December and called home and told his brother, I don't think I'm going to make it. I have a lot of underlying conditions. And he was like, I love you, but I think I'm, you know, I don't think I'm going to make it. And, you know, then he ended up on a ventilator in the hospital, and, you know, his brother went to visit him. It was the second time they'd seen each other in whatever 25 years since the arrest. And, you know, he was chained to a hospital bed and dying. And, you know, he ended up becoming one of the, you know, one of the 200 some federal prisoners who died of COVID.
So Carrie, tell us, is there something that can be done in the system to create a more fair process, one that preserves more lives?
Yeah, sure. I think that most immediately, the thing that could actually be changed better is home confinement. Compassionate release, there's a lot that could be done with that. But home confinement is the thing that's sort of most immediately pressing, because there's a few thousand prisoners that, under the current DOJ interpretation of the CARES Act, would have to come back to prison when the pandemic is over. And if Biden's administration reinterprets that, then those people might not have to come back to prison. So that's something that's sort of been hanging over the heads of, you know, a few thousand prisoners and the legal community for the past few months.
Carrie Blakinger is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.